I'm Dr. Robert Zeev, and this is Healthy Medicine, your show about intelligent, scientific, common sense medicine and strategies for effective, affordable health care. Hi, everyone. We're glad you're joining us today. Healthcare today has been on the agenda and in the national dialogue for many reasons, especially in the last year to 2 years, 2009 to 2010. There have been new federal healthcare law. We hear about rising health insurance rates. We hear a lot about the need for more integrative medicine and the need for more self-care and self-responsibility. And yet, in a lot of these discussions, we can notice that there's somewhat of a polarity, and I think not uncommonly people feel sort of stuck and disempowered somewhat within this polarity. And the polarity I'm speaking of is, on the one hand, you know, the big decision makers in government and insurance and hospitals and institutions that sort of in the way of thinking make decisions for us. And then on the other end of the polarity, taking care of myself. And the question really is there a middle way? Is there a way of bringing these two together in a meaningful way and in a way that can really help to transform healthcare and help all of us to be much more involved on an ongoing basis in our local communities and our own healthcare? Another way of asking this is healthcare a social issue? Is it more than just an institutional economic issue or something of a personal issue of taking care of myself and being self-responsible? How is healthcare a social issue? And this is what we're going to be discussing today with our very interesting guest. And her name is Dr. Pamela Weibel. And Dr. Weibel is a graduate of Wesley College and the University of Texas Medical Branch at Galveston and University of Arizona's Department of Family and Community Medicine. And she is currently in practice in Oregon, and I think in Eugene, Oregon. And Dr. Weibel has pioneered something here which is really catching on nationally, and I think it's an important topic and has a capacity to really transform all of our lives, and it's called community-designed healthcare. So, with that, Dr. Weibel, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Tell us a little bit about this. I know from reading a lot of your stuff and from speaking with you that you were in a traditional, conventional family practice. I think you were in a multi-specialty, at least a practice with many different doctors. And something in you developed that led you towards this vision and manifesting this vision. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, I was, after graduating residency, I went straight into a multi-specialty group, and then actually from there, you know, I was not completely satisfied, you know, because it felt like an assembly line. I really felt like more of a factory worker than a doctor, and my vision of doctoring, both my parents are physicians, so I've sort of been immersed in this field since day one, but my vision of doctoring was more of healing, you know, healing an individual, a family, and a community. And I never really felt that I could do that, seeing, 28, 30 patients a day and doing the whole production line model. I did try several other avenues, because I went from a multi-specialty group to a community health center, which dealt with migrant farm workers. I tried a hospital-owned clinic. I tried small physician practices, you know, that were physician-owned. I sort of tried every combination that was sort of easily out there that I could slide into as an employee, and all of them were pretty much production line scenarios.
When you say production line scenarios, you're meaning that patients are scheduled every 15 minutes, and you have to live within that construct.
Right, and there's not a lot of emphasis on spiritual or emotional treatments, or, you know, really addressing the complete human being. And as you know, many of our physical ailments have emotional and spiritual source, you know, as etiology of our. So it's a real sort of feeling like you're putting Band-Aids on people all day long and
kind of
shooting them through.
I know. I was an emergency physician for many years, and That's often how it felt, that most of the emergencies were not emergencies. It was an extended family practice where you had 3 minutes with each person or 5 minutes. So I know what you're talking about.
Yeah. So not real satisfactory for patients or physicians.
No.
And so I was basically getting to that point where I had considered giving up my profession. I was actually dreaming of going back to my college waitressing job. Just so I could be nice to people again, you know, hang out. And I know I could bring coffee and cream and sugar and, you know, kind of laugh and joke around with my customers in a restaurant scenario, but it's just I was never able to get that sort of quality of human interaction going in, so in those typical offices.
Yeah, and so you had a dream. And
I had a dream that, wow, if we're all so unhappy with this, why don't we just get together and create kind of our ideal medical clinic? And so I just called the paper and set up a bunch of meetings. I had 9 town hall meetings in 6 weeks, and I invited my entire community to design their ideal medical clinic. And I told them, hey, as long as whatever you're telling me is legal, I'll do it. And I mean, I got some off-the-wall ideas, collected 100 pages of written testimony, adopted 90%, and we were open within 1 month. So it's not rocket science.
So, you know, and you did
deliver what people want.
And you got a pretty good turnout of people in the community
right.
to do this.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I did.
Mm-hmm. And then, so you set up a clinic within a month. And how, so in other words, you invited people in the community to be active in the decision-making as to how your clinic would be set up and run.
Yeah, and I mean, you can call it my clinic, but I like to call it, you know, the community-designed clinic, because essentially I'm more of a public servant fulfilling, you know, the will of the people, you might mm-hmm. say. And so I really see myself as serving them rather than myself previously as holding patients hostage to something that was not of their own design. And, of course, I felt held hostage as well mm-hmm. to the standard medical model.
And I would say that probably a lot of physicians probably feel trapped in that model, even though they don't get a chance to talk about it. It's not just the patients who feel trapped.
Right. And then most physicians don't have enough kind of free time to just reflect and get out of survival mode. And a lot of physicians are not necessarily that inclined to sort of lead political rallies and have town hall meetings, you know, but I think this can actually be done anywhere if we just sit around and talk to our neighbors or talk to church, you know, people at our church and ask them what they want. And if we're willing to really think outside of the box, it's so simple what people really want, which is just, they want to sit in a living room setting with somebody who's more like a friend who happens to be their doctor.
Yeah.
You know? We all pretty much want the same thing.
Yes, we do. Let's listen to a clip here from one of Dr. Weibel's gatherings and invitations to the community to speak about what they wanted.
Hi, I'm Carrie from Western Dairyland. When my goat was sick, I was able to call the Osseo Augusta Veterinary Clinic, and Dr. Linda showed up at my farm in Augusta, went out into the pasture, put her hip boots on, brought her 6-year-old son with her, and her intern, went out into the pasture, listened to us, involved us, we all chased him down, and took care of him in the barn. Then she went on to the nesting box, where we had a new litter of kittens, and took a look at all of those kittens to make sure that they were okay, and gave us what she thought the gender was. And then she went to the house and set up on our porch a triage table for my house cat who was having some issues, all to the cost of a $35 house call. That's what I want. That's what, maybe not to be treated like a human, but like a goat.
It sounded like people had a lot of fun at these gatherings.
Oh, yeah, they did. And actually, that one was from Wisconsin. As you mentioned, this is a trend around the country, and I've been called in to various communities. And in that particular community, I'm helping a hospital system actually design an ideal hospital and an ideal regional health care system. So we led these huge town hall meetings there. That one had about 300 people. And there's just a lot of positive energy and enthusiasm among most citizens and communities to really do this. And it's really an answer, you know, I think a better answer than waiting for politician saviors.
Leon, let's talk about that since you brought that up, about your work at the hospital in Wisconsin there. How did you come about meeting and dialoguing with the CEO of the hospital, and how did this come about? What was his experience in his life that led him to be attracted to work with you in this?
Well, he heard about me because his board chair was actually driving down a little country road in western Wisconsin, and he heard me on National Public Radio being interviewed. He was very excited because essentially what I was talking about is what this hospital has been trying to do for some time, is really gather high-quality input, you know, from their community. And as you know, in healthcare, most of the time we're gathering information through scaled questionnaires or people circle strongly disagree, strongly agree. We don't ever get the opportunity to really ask people what is your dream and actually experience deep listening with one another. And so I think this really appealed to them. They're a Catholic mission hospital, so part of their mission is to really serve and serve the, you know, the poor and the needy. And this particular CEO was so turned on about this because he's actually a very spiritually evolved person, I believe, as a result of the death of his 8-year-old son when he was, a younger man. Mm-hmm. And I think when you experience something like that, you either evolve or devolve because it's intense. And I think it forces you to kind of take a bigger picture approach to life and look at the spiritual context of your life. And what you're actually doing in your work. And so he made it, actually he tells a great story, which is that, you know, his son, of course, got the best of care because his father's a hospital administrator, so he went to the best hospitals around in the 80s. He got excellent medical care, his father says, but just horrible care from the nurses and the staff who are overworked, who would come in complaining about how tired they are while his son is dying of cancer, you know?
Wow.
And just... He made a decision there. If he could ever stop that, if he could ever change the way hospitals are run so that people could actually be dealt with on this more human level, that he would spend the rest of his life trying to do that, improving the patient experience.
So that's a great story.
He was ready for me, put it that way.
Yeah, that's a great story. And it's sort of like the example of the doctor who went through an illness and had to experience how impersonal the hospital system is and becomes motivated to change as a result of that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right.
And so to continue that a little bit, then what did you do in that situation? I mean, talk about the ideal hospital a little bit.
Well, you know, though they hired me to come in and lead this, I really consider myself more of a community organizer because I'm not really what they say, you know, that I'm not delivering fish, I'm teaching the community how to fish, you know, so I'm just basically almost teaching people how to be human again and interact with each other and experience, you know, deep listening with one another. And I think in organizations as large as hospitals, you know, sometimes they're run in a real hierarchical fashion, and we've lost that that real connection, you know, between the CEO and the average, you know, working person in the town. They don't often hang out. You know, they don't get to really kind of understand where each other's coming from so that we can meet each other's needs. And so it was just amazing. I told them, you know, I would come for a short period of time. It turned out to be 48 hours of during which I led 13 sessions, or I was involved in 13 events. Two of these sessions had over 300 people, and then I specifically told them we need to go out, since they're a Catholic mission hospital and they want to serve, you know, the marginalized groups. I said, we need to find out who are these marginalized groups. So we went out and did smaller panels with the Amish, you know, who would never attend a big community luncheon in a ballroom, right?
Mm-hmm.
We went to meet with the Hmong. I went to see kindergartners and fourth graders and eighth graders, just kind of a diverse group of students, because often children are excluded from designing healthcare, having any say in healthcare. They just come into the emergency room when they have an asthma attack.
And they're usually done upon. Let's, Pamela, let's take our first break here, and then I want to really come back after the break and talk about this in much more depth with Pamela Weibel, Dr. Pamela Weibel on Healthy Medicine. Hi, this is Dr. Zeeb, and we're back on part two of this show on community health care, and we're interviewing Dr. Pamela Weibel. Dr. Weibel is a family physician in Oregon. She is a graduate of University of Texas Medical School and University of Arizona's Department of Family and Community Medicine, and her website is www.idealmedicalcare.org. And Pamela, so actually just looking at that website, I mean, it seems really like what you're doing is appealing to people to really dream what their ideal is and then ask questions with each other and plan on how the ideal can become practical. Yeah?
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. And when I spoke in Wisconsin, I was trying to relay really how simple this is. So I gave the analogy of the Make-A-Wish Foundation, because there are cynical people who think, oh, dreams can't come true. But dreams come true every day at the Make-A-Wish Foundation, and how that happens is simply a child, you know, will voice their dream, you know, whether it's to go to Disneyland with their family or, you know, go in a hot air balloon or whatever it is, you know, some sort of fantasy type dream. And what happens is you have another human being, you know, at Make-A-Wish Foundation who adopts it, who adopts that dream and sees it to fruition. Mm-hmm. And that's all we're doing with healthcare here is, well, you know, you don't have to be terminally ill. You don't have to be under age 18, you know. You can be a hospital CEO and have a dream. You could be, you know, a goat farmer and have a dream. And then the dreams are very simple to bring to life. And that's what we're essentially doing, is adopting each other's dreams as our own.
And starting to recognize the common connections between the dreams once you hear other people.
Mm-hmm.
What happened, yeah. I mean, what have been some of the outcomes? Actually, before I ask you that, I want to listen again to one of the clips. And I think there was a guy, Brent, who was at one of the big meetings in Wisconsin there, talking mm-hmm. about how if the hospital would make a shift, what his feelings were. And let's just listen to that for a second.
My name is Brent Hafley. Some of you know me from the Chippewa Valley Free Clinic, but I'm actually speaking on behalf of myself right now. This may be overly simplistic, but I can't change tort reform, which is all the lawsuits and that kind of stuff, but I wish that there was a way for me to waive my right to sue the hospital, and in exchange, that the hospital would work in my best interest and not practice defensive medicine. There's a policy that...
So what happened in that presentation? Was the head of the hospital there? And also, were there other doctors who were there in these meetings too? What happened after Brent's comment?
Yeah, well, everyone was obviously thrilled and in agreement with that, because I think most of us would like to be treated as human beings and not as, you know, he mentioned later on, he'd like to waive his right to participate in their policy and actually just be want to hear what's best for him and his family. And so just breaking out of this sort of bureaucracy and getting down to the human level, the CEO was there, you know, and there are doctors as well, and, you know, goat farmers, and I think college students, we had a whole range of people. Mm-hmm. And we're actually in the process of trying to figure out how, I mean, this is more of a long range. It's not an easy thing to do, change the way hospitals relate with people over financing and these policies and malpractice
right.
insurance and all of that. It's not kind of as easy as just adopting massage in the maternity unit or something.
Right.
So, but I think there's like a huge amount of interest in doing that and creating situations like for the Amish. We met with the Amish, and again, they're religiously opposed to lawsuits. Why should they be burdened with a higher hospital bill? You know, and be burdened by, you know, these inflated rates, having to deal with insurance and defensive medicine, all of that, when they're really a simple people that just they're willing to pay cash. And I think that's similar to what Brent had mentioned. He, you know, just the idea of being treated as a sensible human being,
yeah.
and not a number, and
yeah.
not being burdened by you know, all these rules that really, in a way, don't make sense.
And the dehumanizing of how people feel is what you're talking about when they often
right.
come into the hospital.
Right, yeah.
And And so are there changes happening at that particular hospital as a result of these talks, these town meetings?
Yeah, right away we started making changes. We collected 2,800 pieces of information from people. I think we had 1,400 people, you know, basically turn in essay-style responses and speak on video and audio and, you know, that sort of thing. So we're narrowing it down to sort of these. We'd like to get some easy wins and some actionable items that we can just enact that are not, you know, heavy on the finances. Just some quick things we'd like to take off with, and we have done that. Meanwhile, in the background, we're working on the longer range items, like how to enact a bartering system at a hospital with the Amish, how to deal with like decreasing defensive medicine and helping, you know, citizens such as Brent feel that they're not a number and, you know, not held hostage to these policies. So some of the easy things, you know, that we did right away, I mean, we went to a substance abuse treatment center and we asked, you know, gee, what is your dream? And, you know, they pretty much raised their hand and said, we're here for 30 days and we don't have any kind of books or anything to do here. I mean, it's like we'd like something to get our mind off of the trauma of our personal lives, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So we delivered a bookcase within, I think it was a week. They were there with a bookcase, a whole set of books. I think we got Borders to donate books to both of these hospitals because they're dealing with two hospitals in a hospital system in western Wisconsin. So the idea that people really would like to have positive distractions from their illness, you know, just to get into a novel or to have like a, you know, a video game or something that they can do, you know, so artwork. So I think we also delivered art supplies. Then in, to the Substance Abuse Center. Another item is the massage. People really want to have more human touch, and there is a clip about that.
And it wasn't only it wasn't only adults that wanted to listen to massage. Let's listen to this clip.
No, they didn't want massage. I mean, it was also when you listen to the testimony, you hear eighth grade boys. At least five different eighth grade boys told me separately they'd like to have massage.
Let's listen to that clip.
Who knew?
Yeah.
You know, who knew teenage boys were so interested in massage?
Have like a free massage therapy room where you can like chill and have massage therapy.
Who's had massage therapy in here?
I've never done it.
You had like a whole massage?
Yeah.
How's that? It's like pretty amazing, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, so in other words, there was quite a bit of participation, and did anything like that manifest at the hospital after? In other words, what's happened after you've left?
Right, they're actually instituting massage for all staff and patients in these hospitals, and what they've done so far is they have a free massage for all new mothers after they deliver their child. So, and they have 80% of patients who take them up on that. But we're starting in, you know, kind of branching that out into massage at the substance abuse treatment center, and also, you know, just kind of generally for the rest of the patients in the hospital have access to that. I don't know if you realize this, but back in, I think, the 60s or so, every hospital, the nurses basically would massage the patient's back before bedtime. Wow. I didn't even realize that. I went to another hospital recently, and they explained that was the norm.
In the 60s?
Was, you know, yeah, then I think in the 60s and 70s. I forget when they stopped this, you know, but of course they saw that it wasn't bringing in lots of money. So they had them, you know, do other tasks, I guess. But they used to just kind of a brief massage, I mean, meaning like 5 minutes they'd go in. I mean, isn't this nice to have a nurse come in, tuck you into bed, you know, when it's time to really go to sleep. They heat it up like a piece of flannel. They would put that, I think they would rub you with some like oil or lotion on your back and then just put that hot piece of flannel and then tuck you in. So just a really brief back massage that every patient used to get.
I think one of the frustrating things for nurses working in hospitals is that, because I used to hear this when I was in the hospital system, is their jobs had been greatly narrowed down to become basically people who either handed out pharmaceuticals, drugs that were being prescribed for people, or who had to do a lot of charting, and there was much, 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 much less time to really be involved with the patient.
Yes, and I think we all suffer for not having that human contact. I mean, think of all the kids that are, you know, ADHD and Ritalin. I mean, if we had massage available for more, you know, kids. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. I'm just curious how that would change things. You know, look at all the kids that are on psych drugs. I mean, that's a big issue. Lots of kids on psych drugs.
So did you have dialogue about some of the more core issues? In other words, how a hospital needs to stay in business, you know, basically the dependence on procedures, the dependence upon surgery, so forth and so on, the core things that a hospital really requires economically in order to continue in its present form.
Well, these meetings were not about implementation. They were about kind of freely allowing people to express their dreams. The implementation portion comes now. Now is when we have a community team, a dream team, we call them, and a colleague team at the hospital that are actually kind of going step by step with each one of these requests and figuring out how to implement them and make sort of the numbers work. And they're pretty optimistic that they could do most of the things that people have relayed as their dreams, because most of them, let's just face it, are pretty simple. Just about humanizing the experience. And this particular hospital system is in pretty good financial shape, so they would actually be in the perfect situation to be able to adopt some of these more challenging ideas like bartering. And they do an amazing thing with local foods there. You know, I think 15% of their budget goes towards local farms. They have local foods being served in their hospital, which is something people requested, you know, healthy food, organic food in the hospital, and they're moving right into that direction.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Let's listen to another clip here of Judy about her images and her dreams about the hospital.
I'm Jody Hagedorn, and the hospital of choice would be Choice. Feng shui buildings with grounds, organic gardens, aromatic and fruit trees, waterfalls and aquariums, mosaic murals on all the walls and the outside of the building, reflexology paths, the only reflexology path to date, or maybe there are a couple, in Kuala Lumpur that Exxon funded because of its spill. And so why not do this just because? All staff members rewarded, and maybe not even considered staff, but us, rewarded for wellness days instead of sick days. Integrative practitioners available as part of all treatment plans and menus. So when you go, just as you do to a restaurant, you choose. And I would suggest you have dessert first, because then when you're full, you don't have to worry that you didn't get to have it. And more than that is to ask first and foremost, as Pamela does, what's your passion here on this earth? Why are you here? And do you love to sing, dance, and draw? And when did you stop? That might have been when you got sick. Thank you.
Okay. that was great.
Yeah, and her name's Jody. She's actually, what was amazing about this, before I even arrived in Wisconsin, I had called approximately 131 people there because I wanted them to kind of have an idea of what this would be about. And I think it's hard for people to really understand what this is about from a billboard or from a flyer, you know. And so I had personal conversations with people ahead of time, and people got very excited that I was coming to town to facilitate this. And Jody actually emailed me, having heard about me through somebody else in town, and she was so excited that I was coming to do this that she held a powwow and a fire pit thing in her backyard. As soon as I got off the airplane, I met with the hospital team, and then a Native American flute player picked me up from the hotel and took me to a powwow. And it was just great. I'm just trying to explain how energized people are about this and how receptive a community is when a hospital is willing to actually reach out and listen to them.
So how do we know, how do people in other communities who are listening to you talk right now know when their hospital is ready to reach out and listen to them?
I think that we inspire each other by just making human contact. And so if you know the hospital CEO, if you know a doctor in administration, and instead of just kind of waiting again for politician saviors to come from Washington to design something for us, just having those personal conversations, you know, with your neighbor who might be a doctor, or your, you know, the hospital CEO, just make an appointment with the hospital CEO of your local hospital and just have a heart-to-heart conversation. You know, maybe show them, look, this is happening in other places in the country. You know, nobody likes to be the last one to adopt something good. And what happens is once other hospital CEOs are watching this, by the way, once they see how successful this is, kind of they all want to jump on the bandwagon. I guess that's just human nature.
Is this happening?
You don't want to be the first one to try something, but when you see something successful out there, you want to jump on it right away.
Is this happening in other hospitals besides there, do you think? I mean, in other words, the CEO of this hospital must go to meetings of CEOs of hospitals all over the country.
I think he's the president of the Wisconsin Hospital Association, so he knows a lot of other hospital CEOs, and they have expressed a lot of interest in this, including, you know, they've got Mayo Clinic as their kind of big competitor hospital in town, and he's that CEO has talked to him and actually you know, seemed a little bit kind of, what would you say, taken aback by this kind of unusual technique that we're using to interact with the community. And so, you know, they're all very curious about how this is working and how they ever kind of came up with the strategy, because there is no hospital consulting firm that you can hire to come in and do kind of a community organizing spiritual awakening in your town. I mean, that's just not something that's offered right now, you know?
Yeah, I
know. They all pretty much do it the same way with PowerPoints, graphs, and charts, keeping up with the Joneses. It's all, you know, hospitals generally are kind of competing with each other on who can have the biggest five-star hotel-looking hospital with all these fancy bathrobes and amenities and biggest equipment and fanciest IT stuff. You know, not a lot of hospitals are competing on spirituality and human service, you know, really treating people as human beings. And so what's beautiful about this hospital system is they're going right back to their Catholic mission, which is, you know, mind, body, and spirit, really treating each person as a treasure, you know, with a life's purpose.
Now, you mentioned that you talked about step one was dreams and step two is implementation. So basically,
right.
I think even what I fell into there in the dialogue with you there is that and probably a lot of people do, they sort of fast forward into a quick idea and then how do we implement this instead of leaving the space for the first level of this, which was what do you dream of in a hospital or in an ideal clinic?
Right, because if you just open the paper and you read about healthcare, you know, we're all pretty much asking the wrong question about healthcare. You turn on the news or anything, you all hear people talking. It's very anxiety-ridden speech, and it just is very unsettling to read about healthcare, because when you get right down to it, they're all circulating around one question, which is the wrong question, and the question is, who's going to pay for this? And so everything that you read is all about, you know, how are we going to pay for this? And we never stop to actually think of the question that really should come before that, which is, what do we want? And we've never taken enough time to sit down with each other and ask each other, what is ideal health care? You know, wow, what if we could have everything we want? And everything we want is really cheap and easy to deliver, as I demonstrated in opening a clinic 1 month later after running, you know, 9 town hall meetings in 6 weeks. It's really not hard to do. I think this has been made unnecessarily complicated, probably because the people are making a lot of money off of this, right, and not really delivering the will of the people. So when you get back to being a public servant and really serving people, you can kind of cut out all the middlemen, you know, who are essentially not helpful, right? Not helpful in delivering the health care that people want.
Yeah. And what dreams did you hear the most?
The dreams of, you know, actually accepting life and death with grace, you know, treating people, you know, in a sacred way, right? Addressing them, even if they're disabled or elderly, you know, treating them as if, you know, they are a valuable person. A lot of people, an older woman spoke about how she went in and she had some sort of disability and she was treated like she was completely disabled and they, you know, they just disrespected. I think people need to feel like they are seen and heard.
Good. Pamela, I want to hear more. Actually, we're at the end of our second part, and I want to go more into the dreams part and what you really heard from people in part 3 of this Healthy Medicine Radio Show with Dr. Pamela Weibel. Hi, this is Dr. Zeev, and we're back on part three interviewing Dr. Pamela Weibel. Pamela is a medical doctor, family physician in Eugene, Oregon, and has really opened up something here with community dreaming and planning new healthcare modalities. She is a graduate of University of Texas Medical School, and her website is www.idealmedicalcare.org. And by the way, you can email Pamela any questions. She'll answer them, correct?
Oh, yes. I'm very accessible to patients and anyone in the country who would like help in creating something like this in their own community, or if they just have a question. I also have a map on my website of doctors all over the country doing these sorts of ideal clinics. So just so they can kind of get involved in the movement, that all the information is there, and yes, I am available.
Yeah, and since you mentioned that, by the way, let's sort of go there a little bit, because I know you gave a few examples of other family medical doctors who, as a result of thinking about this in a similar way and working with you and dialoguing, have shifted their practices too. Talk about several of them.
Right. There is one woman, I think this is the most amazing story, Dr. Mariah Emeny in New York, in Albany, New York. She actually had $273,000 of student loans and was single parenting a daughter with cerebral palsy. So, you know, her dream was to be the type of doctor that that I'm able to be now, with this sort of, you know, really relationship-driven practice. But, you know, with all of her debt and everything, she felt completely locked into this assembly line model. But I had several conversations with her, and she networked, of course, with other doctors who were doing similar sorts of out-of-the-box practices. And I just told her to go for it, to really live her dreams. And what do you know? A few months later, she's at some town hall meetings in Westerlo, New York, a small town of, I think, 4,000 people or so. It's a pretty small town, but they wanted to have their own doctor like mm-hmm. they had in the past. Mm-hmm. And essentially, they were so thrilled that she was excited to be this type of doctor for them, because that's really what people want, is the old Marcus Welby, you know, house call type of doctor, that they raised, I think, $2,500 with a bake sale and spaghetti dinners, and they did ice cream socials, and they remodeled an apartment for her family, and they're giving her a building in town where she only pays $1 a year to lease for the medical clinic. I mean, they snowplow her driveway. They give her the garden fresh produce. I mean, they're doing everything they can to support her, you know?
So in other words, what I'm hearing you say about her is, if one was to ask the question, how do I make this kind of transition as a doctor work economically? And the answer is, by engaging in these kind of dialogues, people came out of the woodwork to support her, to make her life work economically too.
Yeah, right. I mean, all you have to say is you're willing to deliver this type of health care, and you will have people jump out of the woodwork. They'll send you unsolicited checks, donations. I mean, you would really inspire an entire town if you were to do something like this, because we're all waiting for answers, and again, waiting for Washington to kind of come up with the one-size-fits-all system that we're all going to jump onto. It is not going to be real pleasant. You know, so I think the sooner we can kind of get up off our lazy boy chairs and put down our remote controls and really engage with each other and be in, you know, basically love each other and appreciate each other again, all of our answers are right here, right next door. And it's beautiful to see it happening all across the country. That's just one story. I've got so many stories of doctors doing these things.
People don't often hear about it. No, they don't often hear about it. And are a lot of these more and more on your website, idealmedicalcare.org?
These actually, I have several physician stories that I think are the most compelling, are coming out in a book this spring. But I don't have those listed on my website, but I could certainly, they could look at the map. They can, if anyone who's interested, just email me and I can certainly help them.
Give us another example besides the one doctor there with the deep debt and how the community. Give us another example of what.
Well, another example is Dr. Amy Solomon, who actually independently of me had already decided to leave corporate medicine and sitting in front of Johnny's supermarket in Boulder Creek, Colorado, just interviewing people coming in and out of the supermarket, asking them for advice, like, how could I serve you? What type of doctor do you want? You know, you know, because it's not working kind of in the typical practice. And she got 75 surveys completed, and she saw the same themes that we all see when we ask people what they want. They want a humanized experience. They want integrative medicine. They want to be treated as an individual. And what she did is she just adopted what people had asked for on those 75 surveys, and 6 months later, she opened the town's new integrative medical center, and they've got a yoga teacher and a shaman and everything in there. And all she did is follow the will of the people.
And is she on the staff at the hospital there?
I think she's also on the hospital staff. She's like an incredibly intelligent woman. Mm-hmm. I mean, she's really well respected in that town. So, I mean, we're not talking about people on the fringe.
Yes.
We're talking about people, you know, mainstream doctors who just are not happy being locked into a system that doesn't work. And so they're coming up with their own solutions. And another one, Dr. Robert Forrester in Modesto, California, he wanted to serve migrant farm workers. But the only way you can do that easily now is you work at a community health center. Well, that's still an assembly line type of a practice. He wanted to really, you know, have, you know, relationships, spiritual, you know, emotional contact with these people, not just shoot them through. And so he came up with this, he also had an epiphany of maybe, and he went to speak to his church, actually had three community meetings, and he came up with this benefactor model where half the clients pay between $600 and $1,500 a year, and he doesn't take insurance, and for that amount, they get all the primary care they need and house calls and 24/7 access. But that amount, which is sort of like a concierge practice,
yeah,
that also adopts another migrant farm worker family. So half the clients in his practice pay nothing, and they get all the care they need, and they're migrant farm workers or other people who are poor, and they're floated through on the finances of the other half of the people who pay a yearly fee. So it's like, what a win-win-win situation for the doctor and the people who want to do good in the world, and they have money and they don't know where to donate it. You know, give it to a doctor who's running a practice like this in your town, and then the poor people are getting free health care, and it's just a beautiful answer, right?
And the people who enroll for, let's say, $1,500 a year, they know what they're doing and where their money is going to go.
Yeah,
it's all transparent.
Yeah, they know they're supporting this doctor. They know they're supporting poor people in their own community to get excellent health care. I mean, this guy thinks he's, I asked him, he said since 2004, since they opened, he's given over $1 million of health, of free services away. He said he pretty much has the market covered on giving away care to the uninsured in their area. So
that's very
kind of cool to see people do this. You know, it's inspiring.
And so you mentioned that when you talked about the main things, humanizing and integrative medicine, which you hear from a lot of people. And I think at the break we were talking about I feel that a lot of people go to holistic medical doctors or naturopathic physicians or acupuncturists and so forth because those are the people more that listen to them. And so I guess the real question, how on a bigger level the community can become active enough to really support the hospital to stay in existence and continue to do its good work economically and in regular medicine, but to bring these other modalities in. That's really where the implementation stage of this comes in, right?
Right, and I think most hospital CEOs realize, including this one who specifically told the town, that they need to get out of the sort of inpatient hospital business as their primary business. You know, they want to reach outside of the walls. They want to treat people in their homes. They want to get into the community. You know, the future is not in these big, you know, hospitals. I mean, yes, you on occasion might need an ICU or you might need the services of a tertiary care center, but most people just need sort of common sense, you know, kind of healthy lifestyle and simple sorts of care, which can be delivered, you know, by all sorts of practitioners, you know, massage therapists and, you know, not just, you don't have to be an MD. You know, we have a shortage of primary care, and that actually can be easily filled in part by just including some of these people who feel ostracized, yet they're certified in naturopathy or acupuncture or, you know, massage therapy, and include them in the solution.
Yeah. How do you talk about solo practice a little bit? You know, because a lot of physicians are still in solo practice. Talk about what you just mentioned there about hospitals, and I know in this area that the hospital here is setting up a lot of clinics in the area, and doctors are sort of leaving their solo practice to work in those clinics so they don't have to deal with the overhead. Of course, the hospital is not bringing in integrative medical practitioners. Talk about that a little bit with solo versus that kind of setup. Can it be humanized also without being an assembly line?
No, I think everything can be humanized. It's just a matter of us really really standing back and listening to each other. And, you know, some people, they do well in solo. I'm definitely a solo by heart type of person. But other people, they don't want to run the business aspect, but they shouldn't feel like their only solution is to be locked into a production model. So I think when you have, you know, CEOs such as his name, Steve Ronstrom, in Wisconsin, somebody who's really open to solutions, to all sorts of solutions. You know, when you have somebody like that who's willing to help physicians set up clinics that actually serve people in new and innovative ways, you know, we're going to kind of come up with solutions by trial and error,
yeah.
You know, by having people believe in us, by listening to what people want, and it's a very organic process. So, I think anything's possible.
And as you were, you know, saying, how that develops is going to be somewhat individualized with each community and the composition and the needs and so forth, instead of the one-size-fits-all model.
Right, right, because everyone knows that's not what people want. I mean, That's what the government will deliver. I'm not for or against any sort of government.
It's not just what the government would deliver. We see that, like, you know, I work with a lot of cancer patients, and unfortunately still in cancer medicine, it's one size fits all. And this is what I know people don't want, because I hear this from patients all the time.
Right. Yeah.
Tell us about there was a feature in the Harvard School of Public Health picked this up. About, I think it was called Renegotiating Healthcare, Resolving Conflict to Build Collaboration. Were you involved with that?
Well, that actually, as a result of getting this model out there more in the press and on radio interviews and such, I've had a lot of people ask me to contribute to books. These three books in particular that I have on my website are listed, but that actually is a book that's coming out from Harvard School of Public Health. The authors contacted me. It's a newer edition of a book that's been out. It's a textbook that's used in academic institutions all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
And it's called Renegotiating Healthcare, Resolving Conflict to Build Collaboration. And it just examines the major trends in healthcare that have the potential to change the dynamics of how we deliver healthcare in the country and in the world. And so they asked me and interviewed me for a section of the book. And so, you know, as you know, showing the possibilities, what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm very honored to be in that.
Excellent.
And another thing along the line of these books is I was asked to contribute to The Goddess Shift, Women Leading for a Change, with co-authors Michelle Obama and Oprah Winfrey, and that's an anthology that came out last spring, and the publisher of that anthology contacted me again to contribute to the next book, which is called Optimism, Cultivating the Magic Quality That Can Extend Your Lifespan, Boost Your Energy, and Make You Happy Now, alongside, you know, Steve Jobs and other amazing people. So I think that, you know, there is more and more that I'm writing about this that's getting noticed, I guess, at higher and higher levels. And I think this is just snowballing, right? You know, the more inertia we pick up, the more radio shows, the more people are aware that there's an answer, right, that hasn't been really widely discussed, you know, on CNN yet.
Yes.
I think it's like a real eye-opener for people, you know? And unfortunately, I do have to say a lot of media is run by you know, ratings, and ratings are higher with scary stories. You know, I had a publicist once who was helping me get this message out, and she just couldn't believe that there was not enough interest in these mainstream outlets to cover this. But, you know, what she's been told is this just isn't scary enough. This isn't going to keep the ratings up. This is too, like, touchy-feely happy, you know. But it's sad that you know, we have some viable answers out there. We have doctors, heroic doctors, doing amazing things. They don't get any airtime. People don't realize there's this option. So I commend you for wanting to share this story on your show.
Yeah, well, it needs to be out there. I mean, this needs to, I would agree with you. In these times where everything gets so pessimistic about things breaking down and crises and so forth, we focus sometimes our attention too much on those and not enough on giving our time to create the ideal and have community dialogue and take a risk that something is going to can really develop out of this in each of our local communities.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's pretty simple, actually. It's pretty easy, especially in a clinic. You know, clinics that are relatively small can adopt these things right away. Or if you're opening a new clinic, a hospital, you know, we're talking about retrofitting a hospital, you know, remodeling a hospital that's already in existence. You know, that's a little more challenging, and I just give them credit for even, you know, hiring me to come in and help them with this. I mean, I just think it's really courageous of them. You know, it would be easier just build a new hospital and start over, you know, that sort of thing. But it's nice. It's nice to see the employees
yes.
excited and the staff, you know, energized by the idea that they could have more meaning in their jobs. You know, one of their core values at the hospital, they have four core values: competence, care, respect, and joy. And they just have, the CEO's told me he has a lot of trouble getting the joy. You know, people just don't always feel joy in a hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if they were to adopt this dream that their community says, you know, that they want, especially listening to the kids with the murals and the aquariums and a little train track and all the things that kids really want in a hospital, you would have joy. It's kind of like the Patch Adams thing, right?
Yes.
You would have a hospital that's full of joy, which is so healing.
And everything that would come with that joy that we can't sometimes even begin to imagine, the ideas and the creativity of people working together that would come out of generating this feeling.
Mm-hmm. And I've reviewed the Make-A-Wish Foundation website and read a lot about the kids who've actually survived terminal illness, and they do state that they believe that their dream is what saved them, that making a wish and having their dream come true gave them the confidence and strength to overcome their brain tumor or whatever their illness was. And they started getting better a lot faster. Now, what would it mean if we had a hospital that's full of joy?
That's
full of, like, little dreams coming true in every corner. You think we have better success rates?
And how everybody heard about each other's dreams, too. And there'd be people would have a reason to live, you know, and a reason to heal from their chronic illness.
Because what's beautiful about a hospital that I realized when I went to speak in Wisconsin is that a hospital, and people don't look at hospitals as sort of spiritual places, but a hospital is where dreams are born and dreams are passed to the next generation. You know, kids are born at hospitals.
What was an example of a surprising and innovative idea that came out of these community meetings? We have only about a minute and a half left.
I think the Amish were kind of, they had some great ideas. You know, the whole idea of using traditional medicine alongside allopathic medicine in the ICU. I mean, they want to use burdock root leaves for third-degree burns, and they know it works, and it works better than what allopathic medicine doctors are doing. And they want to be able to use that but still be in an ICU for fluid support and all the other things that you would need in an ICU. And they have hospitals, I think they said in Ohio, that are willing to do that. And so why not have one in your hometown so you don't have to board a train and go elsewhere to get the care you need? So I think the CEO sitting beside them listening to this, it was a real eye-opener, you know?
I can imagine it was an eye-opener. I would like to see the look on a lot of the staff medical doctors who were on the boards and so forth of the hospitals to see, you know, I think these dialogues, I mean, I look forward to being involved in these kind of dialogues in our local community, and I look forward to this message really catching by wildfire. We're about out of time, and perhaps we can do a second show. Let's just talk about this in the interim.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, and I'll answer any emails that come, and I'll return phone calls. So if anyone is interested in more, please contact me, idealmedicalcare.org.
Idealmedicalcare.org. Thank you, Dr. Pamela Weibel.
Thank you so much.
Yes. Thank you to all of our underwriters that make this show possible and really start taking this to heart, having these dialogues with your neighbors and your physicians and your hospital administrator. Let's see where this can go. Take care, everyone. Bye-bye.
For more information, please contact Dr. Zeev at pinetreeclinic.com or phone 928-778-3500. Healthy Medicine is produced as a public service by Comwest Communications in partnership with KJZA-FM in Prescott, Arizona.